Hello and welcome to a very special edition of Slate Money, normally your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios. I'm joined by Emily Peck of the
HuffPost.
HuffPost. We are joined in the studio by Laurie Santos. You are the most popular professor at Yale University.
Yes. No. Yeah.
I mean, you really are.
Yes, by the numbers, yes.
And we have a whole Slate Plus segment just talking about the crazy that is tertiary education in America right now. But mainly what we're going to do is talk to you about the connection between money and happiness and whether and what direction the causality runs. We're going to talk about wine, because it's my show and we're going to talk about wine. We're going to talk about experiences. And I think to kick us off, we're going to talk to Taffy Ackner about whether happiness is even something which we should be wanting in the first place. All that coming up on Slate Money.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
We are going to take advantage of the presence of Taffy Brodessa Ackner in the studio to explain her theory about why you shouldn't want to be happy.
It's not that I don't want to be happy. It's that it is not the end goal. It is more of an offshoot of the other things that I aspire to. I have a real Calvinism in me that is about hard work and satisfaction, but the feeling of happiness is not my favorite feeling.
What's your favorite feeling?
I sometimes really love sadness, and I am wild for anxiety. I am oh, I would snort anxiety through my nose if I could, and I hear you can, but I've never done that.
So is
counterpoint.
So Laurie, is this true? Is it actually a good idea to aspire to happiness?
I think it depends on what you mean. I mean, I think we're actually a lot in agreement here, because if you're the kind of person who's just actively seeking out happiness, like I want positive mood all the time, then you're almost destined not to have positive mood at all. Because what the research shows is that happiness comes from being other oriented, worrying about other people's happiness, worrying about things that give you meaning that are much bigger than yourself. Right. And so ultimately, the people who are seeking it by just kind of boosting their own happiness, like Pollyanna, smile, 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 they're doing it the wrong way.
Right.
And they're kind of not going to achieve it. So you've actually found the secret to happiness by being so disparaging of happiness. It's pretty impressive.
Damn it. So what's the secret to anxiety? Because
I've not heard the anxiety one.
I love all of the emotions except flatness. I hate flatness. That's the thing that I can't tolerate. But I seek things that make me cry. I love it. If an episode of something was supposed to make me cry and didn't, I saw Dear Evan Hansen and everyone around me was crying and I was so angry. I was why can't I get there? It was awful.
No, but I think this is a thing that, I mean, people love scary movies. People love incredibly sad movies. The scary thing, I really don't like being afraid. It's one of my least favorite emotions. And so I find it completely fascinating when all these people go to haunted houses. You know, there's wonderful, around Halloween time, they do these screenshots of people in the middle of haunted houses and they're making these faces that are they don't look like they're experiencing positive emotion, and yet they're paying $50 a pop.
What do you think they're doing there?
I think it's that we like a wide range of emotion. Right. We sometimes like things that don't feel good in the moment because it gives us something else. You know, hot chili peppers, pleasure often comes from things that don't feel good. And I think that's a disconnect in some of the happiness work. It's not all about positive emotion and positive mood. Sometimes it's about something bigger than that. You know, I made it through that chili pepper and I kind of feel proud and I can get a bigger chili pepper later. Those are the kinds of things that resonate with the human experience.
And I agree that, you know, the people who do work in the positive psychology space are people with a nuanced understanding of the word happiness and how it translates into the world. But I think so much of seeking happiness is about avoiding other emotions. And I don't like, and what happens when you get there? Like, what good did you contribute to the world? Like, what
so
is
that's,
it?
Yeah. That, I feel like that's like the Immanuel Kant sort of view of happiness, right? Which is that you shouldn't aspire to be happy. You should aspire to deserve happiness.
Yeah. And if happiness never comes, the satisfaction of deserving it is a good thing. I'm kind of a grim person, though. I'm like cheerful, but...
But again, you can have... There's dissociations dismal. Between, like, being a grim person, positive mood, and all that stuff. And the other side of happiness, which, like, nerdy social scientists call this the cognitive part of happiness, which mm-hmm. is, like, are you satisfied with your life? Do you have meaning? It's really the answer to the question, all things considered, how satisfied are you with your life?
Right.
And that can dissociate completely from, you know, did you smile today? Did you laugh today? You know, were you experiencing super happy, positive mood? And I think, you know, the happiness research is trying to maximize both of them to a certain extent because, you know, it's nice when they go together for the people who are kind of into happy mood and sort of thing. But I loved your point about people who are avoidant of emotions, because that's a real surefire way
right.
to increase unhappiness. In fact, one of our whole podcast episodes is about what happens when you try not to feel a bad mood, is that it comes back with a vengeance. That's right. What the science suggests.
So, Taffy, you are on the record
yeah.
as wanting to be richer than you are.
Yes, I'm on the record anywhere that will have me on the record for that.
So if it's not to be happy, why do you want to be richer?
For it to be easier, so I could work less hard and still do the things
but
that I
like. Didn't you just say that like the whole like working hard is what makes you
No, I
happy?
Don't mean the work. Working hard makes me happy. Arranging babysitting so that I could work hard makes me miserable.
Like having to be responsible for the house cleaning and the bill
yeah,
paying.
Yeah, a happiness podcast that does not come with a babysitter for me is a little useless to me. I'm only kidding. I can't wait to hear it.
So is that like a better reason to want to be rich?
A little bit. I think one of the reasons that money doesn't make people happy, they're making very funny faces at each other. One of the reasons that money doesn't make people happy is we tend to spend it the wrong way. But a good way to spend it is exactly what you're saying. A strong way to spend money to achieve happiness is to use money to buy time, to get rid of time famine, right? So if you can hire a babysitter so you can go out and do the stuff you need, or you can hire a house cleaner to kind of get rid of the yucky stuff so you can get on with your life, more power to you. And in fact, there's research that shows that people who make time-saving purchases with their money are actually happier.
But also all those money studies come from people who won the lottery, which is like a traumatic event. No one has ever been able to produce for me the person who was given $100,000 extra dollars a year to see how it goes for them. I would like that happiness study.
There was a recent, actually, just in the news recently, there was a wonderful like bank error on this where a bank accidentally gave a couple an extra, I think it was like $100,000 or $120,000. And then they just didn't say anything. And they spent it. And they claim that it actually didn't make them as happy as they thought.
That's
because
they're morally abhorrent. They're feeling
guilty.
They're terrible people.
We have to work with banks to do this. I mean, as a social scientist, I would love to see this experiment. You know, we have to work with what we have. But
I'm just saying someone should take one of those grants and just give it to a person like me.
Even, yes. Exactly.
I'm volunteering.
I'm hearing all the foundations typing to you right now. No, but there are studies with folks who just happen to naturally be rich or came into money through their jobs and stuff like that. And what you find with them is, again, it's surprising to those of us that don't have a lot of money, but they self-report not being that happy either. And there's a couple of funny things that come with like really high wealth. One is that they're incredibly guilty a lot of the time because they're not happy and they think everybody else wants to be rich like me and I'm rich, like what's going on? But the other thing is that they have really struggle with social relationships, which I find interesting.
Yeah.
Like it's really hard to meet new people and to get a sense of like these people want to hang out with me because of me as opposed to these people want my money. In one of the podcast episodes, I interview this guy, Clay Cockrell, who's a psychotherapist to the rich, although it's super wealthy. So all his clients earn more than $50 million a year. And what he finds is that, you know, he gets a lot of them because they're miserable. But the number one thing they report is like not being able to make friends. Like he tells this story of one client who like went to the gym, like joined a kind of crappy gym to like meet people and talk to them. And he couldn't have a conversation with them because he's like, you know, what did you do this weekend? I took my wife to a new restaurant. And the rich guy's like, I flew to Paris to try a new wine in my vineyard. And it's like, you just can't connect with normal people.
Counterpoint. The people who earn more than $50 million a year have something crazy going on in their heads that make them have a bevy of other symptoms of being antisocial. Because the amount of people you have to walk over to make even half of that,
a mere $25 million.
A mere $25 million. Or $1 million. Like, I mean, there is an idea that people at the top of any pyramid are sociopaths.
So
I think there is also something interesting because I listened to one episode of your podcast where the psychiatrist to the rich was on. And there was also something you were saying about sort of you reach a set point. So like maybe you're poor and then you come into a lot of money and for the first little bit, you're like super excited because your life just got so much easier. But then you get used to it.
You become
and it's not as hard.
Wherever you go, there you are. That's
exactly.
The thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would just like to be where I am with more money. Why is that controversial?
So, Taffy.
On this podcast.
before we lose you from this podcast, because we are going to lose you in 1 minute.
Because I'm not relevant to this conversation.
Because you are totally relevant to this conversation. I need to ask you about a fictional character.
Yes.
Rachel, in your book.
In my book.
She earns, what, like $3 million a year, something like that?
Yeah, about that. Three, four.
And what does that do to her sort of mental happiness?
It doesn't change her happiness at all. It gets her closer to her goals. And the thing that happens to her because she is erased from the record of motherhood relevance by her husband because she's earning money. It doesn't really have that. But that said, I don't think money's going to make her happy. She was already kind of wealthy.
Why does she feel the need to make so much money?
Because she lives on the Upper East Side and she doesn't want her kids to be the poorest people they know the way she was the poorest person she knew.
Is it true?
It's a symptom of being raised in an area where you are the person who has more money than most of the people on earth and less money than everyone you know.
Is it true that, as one person I know who read the book said, that most, if not all, of the problems in this book could have been solved if they just all moved to Brooklyn?
I would like that person to say it to my face.
She makes more than her husband, much more.
She makes much more than her husband, who already earns a lot of money being a doctor. But everyone's in finance now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You. Taffy, thank you for being here.
Yeah. What was it? See it to my face.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Okay, so Laurie, let's zoom back and try and answer the big question that we brought you on here to answer, which is the relationship between money and happiness and when and how and whether money can buy happiness, because I have a feeling that it maybe can, and you have a feeling that it maybe can't?
No, I think it's complicated. I think whether or not money can buy you happiness depends on how much money you have right now, and also depends on how you spend it. You know, so if you're currently living below the poverty line and you get some extra infusion of cash, yes, that is going to make you happier. It's going to make you less stressed. It's going to increase your positive mood. If you're like, you know, kind of middle class, maybe getting a little money will help you. But if you're earning over $100,000 a year, in most places in the country, a doubling your salary is not actually going to improve your well-being on most standard measures. It might make you think your life is better. Like you sometimes like have this kind of ladder of satisfaction if I'm achieving more in my life because I'm making more money. But if I look on the ground at your well-being, your stress levels in the moment, not going to see any difference.
And that's a household income, like including kids and mortgage and all,
yep,
of, the,
so this
all
was,
of the things.
This was a study done by Danny Kahneman and colleagues, like where he looked at three different measures of well-being and then tried to look at that across salary levels. And at low salary levels, like 10K and 20K in the US right now, you see this like steep rise. Like you're basically doubling your well-being every time you double your salary. But then everything levels off in the US around 75K. And it like really levels off, right? So if you start looking out there at people earning 200K and so on, you're seeing like the same levels of well-being as somebody earning 75K.
Are they maybe looking at the wrong measure? I mean, because we know that like richer people literally live longer, have better health. I mean, is that when they say measure of well-being, are factors like that included? Because perhaps nothing can actually buy happiness. As we were just saying, happiness is complicated and it's not about pursuing happiness. It's about pursuing this other stuff. But there are all these other sort of health measures
buy. I mean, healthier people are happier, right? Generally?
That is true, but the causal direction actually goes the opposite way, which is kind of crazy, which is happier people tend to be healthier. So one study brought, this was measuring happiness as positive mood. You bring people in, you have them fill out questionnaires, you're generally a positive mood person. Then you expose these folks to rhinovirus. Like you have them sniff something that has like the virus of the common cold in it. And then you look at who gets sick. And the people who generally have more positive mood are less likely to get sick. Happy people actually live longer. But again, that seems to be, you measure happiness in someone's 20s, and then you look, do they live into the 90s? And you find your happiness in your 20s actually predicts whether or not you're going to live longer.
But rich people also live longer.
Rich people,
so rich
also
people are happier then.
Well, you know, actually, the causal arrow for happiness and riches also goes in the opposite direction. So I measure your happiness level in middle school, right, when you're like 13 or 14 years old, and then I come back in your 30s. And what you find is that people who are in the lowest quartile of happiness levels at 14 have the lowest income levels. I think they earn something like 30% less than other folks. And so this is what, I mean,
have you done any studies on like if you name your kid Felix, which means happiness, is he more likely to
I think that's next on the agenda for these social scientists. No, but this is crazy. I mean, what we think is that you have to do this stuff to get happiness. I have that intuition too, incredibly strongly. Like I think, you know, if I win the lottery, I'll be happier. If I, you know, get some Hughes raise or my podcast does really well, it will make me happy. But the strong data suggests that the other causal direction is there too, that happiness predicts all this stuff. It predicts voting behavior. It predicts whether or not you're going to ace a job interview.
Wait, what does it say about how you vote?
So happier people tend to vote more often.
Huh.
So they're more likely to vote, which is kind of, again, very counterintuitive.
Again,
right?
Rich people vote more often than poor people don't vote.
Huh.
Anyway, so all these causal arrows are like really complicated. Mm. But I guess the thing is that what the data bear out is that we have these super strong intuitions about this stuff. I mean, you should see how much the students fight with me when I present the 75K data. I usually have a line of these Yale students who all want to go into finance that's like 50 kids long who are like, but what if I live, you know, in like, you know, I really want to live in the Upper West Side, like definitely 75K. And it's like, you know, well, you know, to be fair, we haven't done exactly that study of people exactly in the Upper West Side with your background, but by and large, you know, the averages kind of look like this. And so our intuitions are like really, really strong.
So it seems to me that most Americans think that they're above average drivers. I think I'm the only exception to this rule. But basically all—
I also think I'm not a great driver. I'm
really bad driver.
But basically all Americans think that they would be much happier and or better off if they won the lottery. And like— this is the, I mean, statistically speaking, we know that's false. Like the lottery study is the one which is super robust and that's been studied a lot. And we know that winning the lottery does not make people happier. And yet everyone is convinced they're the exception to that rule.
Oh, yeah. My dad is like obsessed with winning the Powerball and has like a detailed Excel file of like how he will spend different amounts of money once he wins. And it's like, I'm like, Dad, you realize I go on the radio and say this is crazy. And yet you play the Powerball all the time. This is like embarrassing. But it's like, no, he's like, well, those people you talk about, honey, they don't know how to spend it. And so it's like, so we all have this.
So are there any exceptions to the rule?
I mean, I'm sure, you know, again, like the world is large. I'm sure there's some people who play the lottery who get happier. But my guess is that those people did a few things that most lottery winners don't. One is that they spent their money the right way. You know, they probably gave a lot of it away to charity, gave a lot of it away to other people. They found ways to continue their social relationships, which is really tricky with lottery winners because, right, you know, if you're playing the lottery, you're probably in a lower income bracket and now you have $500 million and no one else in your family does, right? You're going to be living a lifestyle that's really different from all your friends from before. And that can cause these disconnects that you don't expect. When we think about winning the lottery, we think about like sitting in a bathtub with money, like, you know, Scrooge McDuck or something. We don't think like how awkward it's going to be of who pays the tab when I want to go to a fancy restaurant in New York and you kind of can't afford it, right? Like those things aren't.
I didn't get that example because just pay the tab, you're rich.
But then it's like, do you pay the tab all the time?
Do you have friends? Do you have friends who always pay the tab?
Just one. And, I have a friend like that.
Doesn't that make you feel icky?
Does that make you feel a bit awkward?
No. No, it doesn't make me feel awkward. It really doesn't. Sometimes I'll offer to go out someplace else and I'll be like, I'm going to pay, so can we go to this shitty diner or whatever? But I don't know. I feel like if I have a friend with $500 million and they don't just pay, then what's wrong with them?
I mean, when you talk to the actual Rick's vote, I mean, that's like one example of a calculus they're doing all the time.
Yeah.
Now that I teach about happiness, I get to, you know, be a speaker at all these wonderful kind of finance events. And I talk to like people who are in the incredibly super wealthy category. And they'll say things like, one stressor I have is that, you know, with this money, I can really help. I can really do something good. I can help something. I want to give it to charity. But which one? Like they experience an opportunity cost of like, I could donate this to cancer, or I could give it to a political party that I care about, or I could stop homelessness. Like, and what my choice is.
And then they have like paralysis and they don't give it to any of them.
Exactly, right? And I think, or like, you know, I'm going to give it all to my family, right? You know, I'm going to give it away to my family, but, you know, that cousin has addiction issues. Like, am I enabling that? You know, should I make my kids rich? You know, is it a good idea to just like give your kids a huge trust fund? Like, what does that do to their sense of meaning?
Well, what
their
does
sense
it do?
I
mean, you're the expert. If I have a trust fund, does that make me less happy?
Well, I think it kind of messes people up. I mean, you know, in a lot of ways, we don't expect this, but sometimes happiness comes from adversity, right? It comes from pushing yourself really hard and thinking you have a life with meaning. You know, if all of a sudden you get infused with some cash, like, and you don't have to do anything anymore, like, you know, why do you even get up in the morning?
I was thinking about that because so much of when you're an adult, you sort of like make up a story about yourself and how you became successful. And so it's great to have a story where you start kind of, I had nothing and I bootstrapped or whatever. And now look at me. But if you come into it with a trust fund, even if you do accomplish a lot, there must be some feeling of like, I had so much help. Maybe it makes you, is that what you're saying? It makes you feel bad.
That's right. You know, I think that guilt issues are just like so profound in these like groups of the super wealthy because, you know, they get that they, you know, they don't, not everybody has what they have, right? And so they kind of feel guilty about it. I think that's especially true when you're.
You don't even need to be super wealthy, right?
No, I think that's right. I mean, I think even if you're a person who has an income that's even slightly higher than your friend group, you know, I see this in my college students who finish, you know, there's some that like go off to grad school and are penny pinching and there's others that go into finance and they were roommates for 4 years. And it becomes hard to kind of navigate that rift, even for people who really cared about each other. So money doesn't always kind of bring the ease that we think. Sometimes it comes with more complications than we expect.
That said, doesn't it bring the ease, though? Because we've all been like in the penny pinching situation where it's like every time you leave your apartment, you're faced with all this these depressing things that you can't afford anything. Every choice you make in a store requires a lot of arithmetic in your head, and it's extremely stressful. We know that. And having money does make life easier. Really does. Like, I feel like saying poor rich people can't decide where to give. I have a hard time feeling.
And I want to jump in here and just sort of say, like, on the one hand, we all can agree that if you're poor and you know, are literally like looking at prices in the grocery store saying, what can I afford? Mm-hmm. That's stressful. But I'm going to come out and say that even significantly above $75,000, like, you know, there are always money constraints. We're not talking about the super wealthy. Mm-hmm. If you're earning like $200,000 or $300,000, it's like that's a finite amount of money, and the ability to sort of, so, you know, let's say you're traveling somewhere and you look up where the good restaurants are and you say, oh, that one looks good, let's go there, and not having to worry about how much it costs or whether you can afford it is a degree of freedom that is that makes you happier.
Yeah, that's what I think.
And so in that sense, like the difference between $100,000 and like $300,000, you'd think would make a difference.
Mm-hmm. But I think the problem is that if you actually talk to the people who are earning like the $300,000, what happens is it comes with other consequences that we're not thinking of, right? Like now the difference between the restaurants you were thinking of at $100,000, you're like, oh, I could go to that place and just not think about it. That's not where the $300,000 people are eating. They're feeling sad that they can't go to the restaurant we don't even know about. It doesn't have a sign. Like mm-hmm. we can't afford it, right? And they have other constraints now. You know, now their kids are in a special, super expensive private school, right? Right now, they're hanging out with people who wear, you know, off the runway clothing, right? So they feel bad and they have to put it in. Like, this is the problem of what scientists call hedonic adaptation, right? Even when you get to an awesome level, like, you just think, you know, I'm used to it now. I'm like comparing myself against other people who have more. I've forgotten what it was like to do the penny pinching.
What it's like.
Yeah. One of the studies we talk about in the podcast, which I just find so striking, is so you ask people at different wealth levels, like, how much would you just need to be happy and reduce your stress, right? So you ask people earning 30K right now in the US, how much would you need? Those folks say, if I just got 50K, I would be fine. Wouldn't need any more. Like all my stresses would be good. So in theory, we should ask the 50K people and they should be like, you know, maybe I'll get a little happier, but basically all my needs are met. No. The article that reported this actually asked folks who were earning $100,000, how much do you need? And those folks say, I need $250,000. Then I would be good. And so there's two things about that. One is that because of hedonic adaptation, you never feel like you're done, right? You always want some more. But the more striking thing is that the ratio actually goes up as you get more money. So 30,000 to 50,000 is less of a jump than like 100,000 to 250,000. And so I think that's the, you know, that's the problem.
Am I the only person who's actually happy with how much he's earning?
You might be spending it correctly. You know?
CNBC every year or the past couple of years, they send out this article. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's this couple who makes, I think, $500,000 a year, and they lay out all their expenses in a spreadsheet.
And they're all very, very stressed and worried.
And they say, we're actually middle class. We make $500,000. We can barely afford to live. And then everyone dissects the spreadsheet, and it's like, oh, it turns out they have like three Land Rovers, and they're paying three private school tuitions, and they're spending $10,000 a month on travel. It's kind of like that. Like they've adapted their lifestyle to sort of, they're still scrapping to get by.
And I think their lifestyle, I mean, all our lifestyles don't exist in objective terms. They exist in a comparison to the other people we live near, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, they might have the two Land Rovers when their neighbors have three, or maybe Land Rovers are kind of gauche and they're sort of like slightly embarrassed that they don't have, I don't know, car differences in wealth levels. But the point is that like you change your environment, you change your expectations, and you change what you're used to in that moment. The way to make rich people happy, honestly, would be have like 2 weeks a year where they went back to penny pinching, where you take away all your money, you're like, nope, dude, you got to go to McDonald's and count like how much, you know, change you have to make it work. I bet if they could just go back to their life after that, they'd feel amazing. And so
it should
lucky.
Be a reality show. I think you.
It would be. Yeah. If anyone's listening, let's make it happen.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Okay, so now that raises the big question, which I've been thinking about all along here, which is, why do we always compare ourselves to people who are richer than us? What is it about this thing where, you know, you can be in the top 2%, but all you're doing is comparing yourself to people in the top 1% rather than everyone else in the other 98%? What, like, it seems obvious that if you are the poorest person in your peer group, you're going to be less happy than if you're the richest person in your peer group. But why does it seem that everyone is the poorest person in their peer group?
Yeah.
That's a good question.
Yeah. I mean, it is that way, sadly, because our minds just kind of suck. Like, this is just a central feature of our mind. It's actually something we share with monkeys. Like, it's just we compare ourselves against others. We don't think in objective terms about anything, including money. We think in relative terms. And our brains find the most salient reference point. So if I ask you, you know, how social are you? How many parties do you go to and so on? You don't think of like some loser who stays home and plays Fortnite. You think of like, oh, that one friend who goes out all the time and I feel embarrassed because I always feel like I'm home. Like your brain always shoots to like the most extreme example. And with money, our brains shoot to the most extreme example. They're salient, right? Like they're the ones who are on TV. They're the ones who are wearing the cool stuff. They're the ones who are parading what they have on Instagram. And so it's like a natural comparison point that we stick to.
So Instagram is a vector of unhappiness.
I think that's there are data that bear that out, that if you kind of assign people to look at Instagram or Facebook or any of the social media for a little while, they come out feeling like they're less wealthy. Television is another route. So one study showed that for every extra hour you watch of TV, you think that you are less wealthy than the average person, and you think that wealth is higher in the U.S. And the idea is like, again, it makes sense. Who are you watching on TV? We're not seeing stories about like, you know, reality TV is not like a bunch of refugees and people who really are earning the norm. Like it's about, you know, the Real Housewives of blah, 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 or just like.
And that's replaced like Roseanne or whatever working class thing we used to watch.
I think that's right. Yeah. And I think even just like the news coverage of people is the rich and famous, right? Like we tend not to focus. I mean, you can name the names of the rich people who are on TV, but I don't think you can name the names of the refugees you saw on TV before. And that's just the way our minds work. Like our minds lock on to the people who are better than us, which is a sucky feature of our mind because it means that we can objectively be doing incredibly well and we feel super awful about it.
This reminds me of something we had on the author of The Meritocracy Trap recently.
Daniel Markovitz.
Yeah.
And he, for his number in the episode, We All Bring a Number, he brought up the poverty rate and he said, you know, people are now, there's less poverty, but at the same time, there's more inequality. And then he said, so why aren't we happy with that? Like,
basically, his thesis in the book is that inequality in the 60s was about the poor, and now it's about the rich. And
yeah,
that's a big change
exactly.
in inequality.
And it kind of relates to what you're saying, because it's like, yes, people at the bottom are theoretically better off, but because people at the top are so much better off that everyone that winds up feeling bad.
Yeah. I mean, most of us, like financially speaking, again, this is all averages, right? But objectively speaking, most of us have gotten better off since the 1950s mm-hmm. in terms of wealth levels, right?
And we have refrigeration
like
and washing
houses,
machines.
Right. Yeah. Smartphones and stuff. But if you look at the well-being data, what you find is that on standard measures of well-being, you don't see much of a difference. If there's any difference, well-being tends to go down.
Even with like air conditioning, you think air conditioning would just obviously make people happier.
You would think, but hedonic adaptation being what it is, even the conveniences of modern life, you know, go away. But that's striking, right? It means like our objective like spot is nothing if we have other people who are better than us. And I think the point in the meritocracy trap is that nowadays we have people who are like way better. I mean, the research suggests we can't even fathom how much higher people are mm-hmm. than normal lay folks. I mean, one of the analogies I heard recently is a step analogy. So if you imagine income in the U.S. and every step is $100,000, right? Most Americans haven't taken a single step on the like staircase, right? Those that do take a first step, like now you're up there. Like how many steps up are a millionaire, right? Well, you know, they're like 10 more steps up, you know, like, mm-hmm. you know, like they're, but then you look at Bezos and stuff like that. It's like, they're like the Eiffel Tower up from mm-hmm. most Americans, right? Like, you know, they're like halfway to the moon and we're not thinking about it. And so it's like, we don't really, when you think about like, oh, there's some people who are like really, really rich. We're not calculating the actual orders of magnitude about how much richer they are. You know, like Bezos can spend the salary of most Americans, like several times over every day
right.
and not notice it like
this
by the end of the year.
This is a conversation I had with Chris Hayes from MSNBC a few years ago where we talked about fractal inequality. And no matter how rich you get, there's always people who are like infinitely richer than you and you always feel infinitely poorer than them. And it never goes away, that feeling of missing out.
Yeah.
It seems like such a failure of the United States experiment because, right, it's all about first, it was John Locke said it was pursuit of property, and then it gets switched to pursuit of happiness. They all get tied up together. Everyone's going for money and happiness, and it's all wrong. It's all misguided. The more money you go for, the more money you get, the less happy I guess you are, and you make everyone else less happy along for the ride too, everyone below you.
And this is like the central problem of the happiness. And one of the reasons we're doing this podcast, right, is that our minds seem to lie to us about the stuff that matters. You know, like everyone's like, all right, pursue happiness. Like, this is great.
I mean, that's literally in the founding documents the country.
But they didn't lay out how to pursue it. And I think their minds just gave them their own.
But, I mean, was that just a bad idea? Was that fundamentally misguided to put like the pursuit of happiness up there with life and liberty? Because honestly, pursuing happiness, it's like, it's not a good idea, right?
Well, I think it's like, I mean, the data again suggests it. Like, the data suggests that, like, it's a pretty good idea. I mean, should we pursue longer life? Should we pursue more civic behavior? Happier people also are more pro-social. Happier people are more likely to recycle and do nice things for the environment. Like, there's so many odd, like, things that
but
happiness
like, you
is
need to get there kind of indirectly. You pursue one thing and you get
well, that's where I think they went wrong. They needed like life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, like asterisks. By the way, what you think pursuing happiness is about, totally wrong. Watch the Happiness Lab podcast and you'll, you know, be able to figure it out.
So I need to ask you about my theory, which I've had for a few years, about the most predictable and certain way that you can use money to buy happiness, which is that you go into your favorite local wine store and you buy a bottle of wine that's about 30 to 50% more expensive than you normally spend on wine. And then you take it home and you drink that wine with a good meal and you are almost guaranteed to feel very happy about
you're
that
drunk?
Wine. There's
controlling like, for alcohol vibe across. Yeah.
There is this very, very robust finding that people who think that the wine that they're drinking is expensive enjoy it much more than people who think that the wine that they're drinking is cheap, regardless of whether it's expensive or cheap. And 99% of the time when we drink wine, we're entirely aware of how cheap or expensive it was. You know, we've just bought it at the store and we know how much it cost. And so I just put those two things together. If you buy something which is expensive and then you drink it, you are going to be happier.
But I have one update to that, which might be better, is that send your friend to the store, you know, with the $50 bottle of wine, but they come back and buy a bottle of $2 Chuck that you can't identify. You think it's a $50 bottle of wine, but they just saved $40 and they can go off and do something nice for themselves. So you get this pleasure and then later he'll be like, psych, here's the $40 back. And, like,
and then you get the pleasure again.
Yeah.
I know. It's like, wow. That's next level happiness hacking right there.
But the other good thing about the wine is what you're spending it on, right? Which is that the wine is not going to be like some material object that sticks around forever and is going to be subject to hedonic adaptation.
And stuff.
If you're like me.
Spending it on stuff is never a good idea,
right? It on stuff is never a good idea. But for funny reasons, one reason is this kind of adaptation, right? Stuff sticks around. You know, everybody's heralding this new iPhone 11. It's going to be awesome. It's going to make everybody happy. But that in some ways is a bad investment on happiness because like your iPhone 11 is going to be there next month. Mm. And you're not going to care about it next month. Your emotions are going to have moved on. And so if you spend the iPhone 11 money on some good experiences or on something else, that might be better.
Sounds like Christmas hangover.
But the second reason...
But ask any teenager, if you don't have a smartphone, that does make you unhappy.
That's true. You need a smartphone, maybe like an iPhone 7 or something like that. But the teenager example gets to the second reason why spending on experiences is better, which is like it doesn't make you look like as much of a tool as if you spend it on material goods, right? So at Yale, everybody's wearing like Canada Goose jackets. That's the like posh jacket for college students. And they're like, you know, above $1,000 to get a winter jacket kind of thing. But there's like a whole culture of memes of making fun of people in Canada Goose jackets. Because when somebody buys a Canada Goose jacket, you think they're a ponce, like, you know, terrible fashion icon, like wasting their money, blah, blah, blah. But if somebody buys a like kind of over the top like vacation or kind of over the top bottle of wine, you don't think they're as much of a jerk as if they spend their money on the material possessions. Mm. And it also, if you spend it on, say, a good experience, then you could talk about that bottle of wine. Like if you told me like, oh man, I tried this really great bottle of wine. It was fruity. Or I went on this cool vacation and I saw all this stuff. If you're like, my Canada Goose jacket is so soft. And it like you just sound like a jerk. No one wants to talk to you. And so experiences also connect us socially in a way that material goods don't.
Is there any evidence that expensive vacations make us happier than cheap vacations?
It's more just the experience of it, right? So I think if you can get as kind of good of an experience for cheap.
But can you? That's the question.
I think so. I think if you're mindful and paying attention.
Emily's like, no, yeah. No, you need the money.
No one wants to stay in a bad motel.
Last night, my husband and I walked down to the Italian village and they have some like big festival and we just kind of watched crazy people and ate fried food. And that cost us like, you know, $12 New York money. And that was pretty fantastic. I don't know if this posher New York vacation would be better.
Money doesn't make you happy, but if you happen to have the money and you want to be happy, spend it on experiences, not on stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And buy time.
And buy yourself some time. The third thing, which again, most people don't like, is give it away. If you have a lot of money.
And he's like, why would I give it away?
This is like, you guys will see, like after this podcast, I'm going to get flamed on Twitter. It was like, who's that Yale lady telling us to give our money away? What's her problem? No, but the research on giving money away. So controlled for income level, people who give more to charity are happier. And controlled for kind of income level, which is not great, people who spend more of their time volunteering are happier. But that's just correlational. There's also lovely experimental work on this where you force people to give money away and you see if it makes them happy. This is some work by a professor, Liz Dunn. And so she gives people money on the street. She's like, here's $20. And she says, spend it on yourself or spend it on somebody else by the end of the day. And then she calls them at the end of the day and at the end of the week and asks who's happier. And everyone predicts that the person who spends it on themselves will be happier because, like, duh, treat yourself, you get something. But it turns out at the end of the day and at the end of the week, people who give it away are happier, which is not what we predict. You know, when I'm having a crappy day at work, I'm not like, and I'm thinking, like, I'm going to get a massage or I'm going to get a manicure. I'm not like, I'm just going to give to some random person on the street a massage or a manicure. But actually, the data suggests that would be better.
I have to say that, you know, we have occasional, you know, philanthropy special issues and stuff here on Slate Money. We're kind of into this idea. And in just my personal experience, I'm with you on this one. It makes you feel really good. Mm-hmm. I do have this sort of idiosyncratic idea that, number one, that charity makes you feel better than philanthropy. That, like, giving money to a person so that you help out a poor person directly makes you feel better than, like, doing some strategic thing to probably make the world a better place in some vague way.
Yeah, we kind of like it when we see the goods, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I bet, you know, donating the same money to kind of some good philanthropy thing for many of us won't feel as good as, like, you just do something nice for a physical person that's there who you see, like, them kind of brighten up when they get the free coffee or the free manicure or something like that. Like,
give money to your friends who need it. It's actually just as effective, on a selfish way. Mm-hmm. It makes you feel really good in a way that, like, giving money to, like, the Red Cross, like, it feels weird. But I also need to ask you, since, you know, you're Yale, like, does this also work for just, like, if you add an extra drop to the $13 billion Yale endowment, does that make people feel better?
In theory, I mean, again, you know, I'm sure Yale would love me to do the exact study of, like, you know, getting lots of donors and stuff like that. Yeah, I mean, I think especially if it gets connected to real people's feelings. So some universities, including Yale, are now doing this thing where they have the folks who get financial aid or get kind of summer fellowship money or something say what they did with it and write back to the person and be like, hey, thanks so much for that $5,000. You know, I was able to go to Bhutan and study this cool, you know, thing I was interested in. Thank you. Like, when you get that letter, it can be incredibly powerful, right? Because now you're like, I see the recipient. This is not some nebulous thing. This is a person who got to do this thing they wouldn't have otherwise gotten to do. And that feels nice, more nice than we expect.
Right. And the other thing, I was just having this conversation a couple weeks ago with a friend of mine who was like, and it was over dinner, and she was just like, if I needed money, she asked us all, like, would you lend me the money? And we all kind of said the same thing, which was like, no, if you needed money, we would give you the money, but we would never lend you the money because lending you the money is just a miserable thing, which makes us all so much less happy.
Yeah. Usury used to be a sin. We kind of lost that with finance, but right. It was a bad thing before.
So is Andrew Yang going to make America happier if he becomes elected president and is able to give everyone $1,000 a month?
I think if everybody, you know, I think we should scale it to those who really, there are a lot of people in the U.S. who need $1,000 a month to put them at that 75K. In fact, most Americans need that to get to the 75K. And I think that really will decrease people's stress and increase people's happiness.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep. While you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now, getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Let's have a numbers round. Do you have a number?
My number would be 700, which is the cost of a new iPhone 11, which if you care about happiness, you should probably not spend on the iPhone. You could spend instead on 365 days of buying someone at work a tall coffee from Starbucks.
I just bought an iPhone 11.
I'm sorry.
You did? Is that it? That's not it.
No, this is my old iPhone 7, and its battery life is about 1 second, which is why I'm always plugging it in when I'm in the studio and using the stopwatch to try and work out how much time the podcast is elapsing, because if I don't plug it in, it runs out of battery and I need a new phone. And it's purple. I mean, purple makes me happy.
There is something there, yeah.
The only number I can think of is 82.
What's 82?
82% is the latest from the Census Bureau. It is the gender pay gap between women and men. Women still make less than men, 18% less. And even though that is true, the Trump administration is just killed an effort to even measure pay gaps inside companies that the EEOC was planning to implement, which that does not make me happy, Lori.
Doesn't make me happy either.
So my number is $60 million, which is, as of the recording of this podcast, the current jackpot for the Powerball. And my theory about playing the lottery is that it makes you happier. I really do believe this. I don't necessarily believe that winning the lottery makes you happier, but I do believe that playing the lottery and spending $2 to have a whole bunch of dreams of wonder what could happen if you were wealthy is something which not only makes you happier directly, but also makes it less likely that you're going to be doing stupid stuff with the other 99.9% of your money in terms of trying to get rich quick. Like, if you can, it's like it inoculates you against get rich quick schemes.
I love it. We used to buy lottery tickets at work, and it was always really fun because the whole team would chip in, and then we have a big conversation like, would you come into work if we won? Who would come in? And we'd all be like, no one would come in. And it was just so fun.
The anticipation of good things that mm-hmm. you buy with your money is actually sometimes better than the things that you get. Anticipating the experiences you're going to do is sometimes better than the experience themselves.
That's
which
why
is
they say take more shorter vacations, because looking forward to the vacation is better than the vacation itself.
And really plan it far in advance, right? Because if you have 2 whole months to look forward to your vacation, it's better than just like kind of deciding on a whim at the last minute.
So are you with me? Is it good to play the lottery even though winning the lottery is a bad thing?
I think there are better things one could do with one's cash.
Okay, so that's it for Slate Money, though. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Jessamy Molly for producing. And we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.